now for Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ehrens.
Well, welcome into our streaming show today. We are so glad you're here on our IUP TV app. We appreciate your time. We got a lot of topics to run through today. First of all, the big, beautiful bill is just craziness. Back in Washington, D.C., we're going to hit a lot of the different aspects of the bill, what made it in, what didn't. As we are recording this, the Senate has passed its version. It needs to go back to the House to concur with the changes or make some of their own. So as we're recording this, we'll discuss what has been done. If we have time, we will also hit on some local issues in that the state has sued Snapchat, the latest in their social media efforts there to crack down on social media companies. And the governor is asking Utahns to pray for rain yet again, asking for some divine help as well as practical solutions. So we will talk about that. Joining me, Sarah Real, of course, and Adam Gardner. Hi, guys. Introduce yourselves.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
I'm Sarah Real. I am on the Utah State School Board representing District 5, and I'm adjunct instructor of political science at Solly Community College.
Professor.
And my views do not represent either of those organizations.
No, they don't. They are Sarah Real's views, and we are glad to have them. Adam, how are you?
I'm a lobbyist. I'm great.
You know what? Capital L, man. We are glad you're here.
Thanks for having us.
Yes. ASG Consulting, right?
Yes.
Is your lobbying firm. Okay, perfect. So let's dive right in, shall we? The big, beautiful bill is big and passing the Senate. What surprised you about what made it into the Senate's version? Let's start there.
Look, I think that the House version was atrocious from a conservative point of view, in that it expanded the debt, our deficit, by $4 trillion. And then the Senate somehow said that wasn't awful enough. We're going to make it $5 trillion. I think that's abominable. We still don't know the full cost of what it's going to be. As I listened to the speeches by Rand Paul and others on the Senate floor, he said, we know next year this is going to be around $300 billion in a deficit, in addition to what we're already spending in a deficit. That's
a
problem.
How are Republicans justifying this? Because it passed, right, albeit with one vote and Vice President Vance being the tie-breaking vote.
There's two things we always do.
Yeah.
Republicans will always do. They'll say, if we would have elected the Democrats, it would have been so much worse. And look, you have like the Inflation Reduction Act and all these other terrible pieces of legislation that skyrocketed the debt and deficit. So sure, that could be true, but you guys are in charge now, so fix it. And they didn't. The second thing they always do is they say, whoa, 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 the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office that scores these things, they're off. They're wrong. Mm. Trust me, the way that they're doing it, the way that their numbers
and
work,
with all this money we're putting back into the economy because we're saving money in taxes, is going to generate revenue.
Look, when they passed the Tax Cut and Jobs Act in 2017, they said that revenue for the federal government would increase. It did. We still had record deficits. Mm-hmm. You can't say that this is going to be, we're going to have all this extra money and it will solve all of our problems if you don't cut spending. And they refuse to do that, which is sad.
Yeah, you're totally right. I agree with you on all those points. And what's interesting for me is that if you took this bill 15 years ago, I don't think you could find a Republican that would vote for it. I really don't. It basically cuts healthcare and makes the rich richer. And we can't continue to keep cutting taxes and expect that our revenue is going to go up. That's not how it works, mm-hmm. right? And so to me, it's almost like the Republican Party has, I mean, I think there are a lot of ways we can cut spending, and I actually would like to cut spending. But what it looks like to me is that the Republican Party isn't really like this party of governing anymore. It feels like they're a cult, because I look at them and I think, do you really think that this is a good idea? Do you really think cutting Medicaid and health insurance for a bunch of Americans is a really good idea? Or is your leader telling you that you better do this or else, right? The one Republican that voted against it is not going to run for office again, right? So
I think you have three Republicans.
Yeah, but even Murkowski, they just were bullied into voting for it in some ways. And
she worked really hard to get her Alaska protection.
Murkowski's kind of, I have I think it's kind of, I mean, I'll push back a little bit on the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. I don't think it just, sure, it does make rich people that pay more taxes, it makes them richer. They get to keep more of their money. Middle class people get to keep more of their money as well. I saw a big change in my paycheck when that passed years ago. So I'm excited for that to continue. So
everyone
I like
loves
that
to
aspect.
Save money.
I don't like to pay taxes. So anything you can cut, love that. Murkowski, just the like political science person perspective, she's like, I'm delivering for Alaska. Like, I'll vote for this monstrosity if you say this only applies to the contiguous U.S. states.
Well,
so only the 48
states. She's getting accused
of
selling out.
For sure.
Yeah, she is. She represents Alaska. Like, I don't know. We all have our different, a lot of people sold out. Democrats, Republicans sell out all the time. And I think the bill was bad, but she's like, look, if this thing's going to pass, Alaska's going to get taken care of. So you can't fault her for that.
Yeah. But like from the principle of like what the Republican Party used to be in favor of it. I mean, I don't love things like trickle down economics. I don't see them working. I've not seen them work well. And so for me, if we have this party that is just making decisions, massive decisions have huge impacts on our country because their leader wants them to, not because they think it's good governing or it's good policy for the people, that's what troubles me a lot. Mm-hmm. Because it's how can we shift this to go back to making good bipartisan policy that actually helps our deficit, that actually helps the people and provides them what they need from their government.
I want to drill into those Medicaid cuts a little bit, because that is where the GOP is saying we're trying to save some money, is getting rid of waste, fraud, and abuse in Medicaid. Did we cut it too much to where some people who deserve to have Medicare health coverage are going to now lose their coverage in order to save some money? Or is everyone that's getting covered under this or getting cut under this a function of waste, fraud, and abuse?
Before we jump into that, if I could just throw on the record, because I think it's going to be useful for the rest of this discussion, the three Republicans who did vote against the bill were Susan Collins of Maine, Tom Tillis in North Carolina, and Rand Paul. Murkowski, of course, as we discussed, did vote yes, but said in an interview with reporters, she's aware that this is going to disadvantage millions of Americans and would like the House to send it back to the Senate for further edits. So, like, the most...
Which I think is a cop.
It won't work because the president would like to sign it on July 4th,
right.
Of course.
Producer so Peter, by the way, everyone, I forgot to introduce you. Peter.
Hi, everybody.
I mean, hi, just thank you for being here. Okay, so let me drill in to those Medicaid cuts. I mean, did we cut too much? Are the people who are going to lose health coverage? Because what I feel like I'm trying to do as a journalist is cut through the rhetoric on this thing.
Right.
We're hearing a lot of the rich are going to get richer. Sorry, you said that, but we are hearing that. And then we're hearing Republicans just want to, you know, take away health insurance from poor people. And I don't believe either of those things are true. So, like, where's the middle ground here? What did we do?
Well, I heard something interesting today, which was that there are different cuts that they're making. I think that there are ways that we can make cuts and adjust Medicare and Medicaid to save money.
I said Medicare. I meant Medicaid. Yeah. Sorry. Mm-hmm. My bad.
And all of it.
We can
make adjustments. But... there are other cuts to the Affordable Care Act. There are changes to the Affordable Care Act with this. And I think people are thinking all the people that are just freeloading from the government, they are just like, they don't want to work. All this is like visual of these people that the government is helping. But the elderly couple in Connecticut that's making $80,000 a year, probably on Social Security or retirement, whatever, they would see a massive cut to their, they would have an increase in their health insurance of $26,000 or 100% increase in their premiums. That is an old couple in Connecticut mm-hmm. that's making $80,000 a year that are going to see that massive change in their lifestyle. And that for them, they're not working anymore. They're retired. They don't have this income coming in. And that is a huge impact in different ways than just we're making it so that you have to have a job before you get health insurance or whatever all those requirements are. I understand those, but there's stuff in here that is more impactful that we're not talking about.
How do you see it, Adam?
So, first of all, I mean, an old retired couple in the Northeast, that's Medicare. That wasn't really dealt with in this bill. On the Medicaid side, look, the way you phrased that question was actually really good, because you said, like, is everyone that right. is that is supposed to not have health? Like, have we carved out everybody?
Right.
The answer for the federal government every single time is no. Whenever they do something broad based around the entire country, they're going to mess it up. That's just the nature of a huge, bloated government. What I think is important is the federal this bill. This is something I actually agree with. This bill, it exempted the people that we're talking about. So it said, we're not going to affect pregnant mothers. We're not going to affect anyone under 18. And they listed all these, if the disabled, right. we're not going to hit any of these groups. What we are saying is if you're between the ages of 18, I guess it would be 19. So 19 and 64, you are an able-bodied adult, without dependents, you need to work to get insurance. Maybe that's the wrong thing to say, a blanket statement across the United States, but I think we should give that a try.
It's really hard, to your point, to make nuanced policy for every individual
and
circumstance.
Mississippi is different than Maine.
Sure.
And Washington State and California and Utah. We're yeah. all so different.
But yep. but fundamentally, it's like, okay, if we think about the purpose of government, we think that the purpose of government is to support people, right? Healthcare is like a fundamental right. And we're doing, instead of making changes and policy changes to try and get people into prosperity, into being able to not have to be have government reliance. Instead, we're going to hit them in the hardest spot, which is in healthcare. And there are those changes with the work requirements, which I think are understandable. I think add a lot of bureaucracy. It's like adding like 20 freaking layers of paperwork to try and get people insured.
The American way.
Yeah, right, exactly. But it's also those Affordable Care Act changes that are gonna impact folks.
Yeah.
Maybe they're not old and they're on the Affordable Care Act. They're using Affordable Care Act and they're making $80,000 a year, right? They're gonna be
sure.
impacted.
We'll have to see how it all shakes out. I also want to talk about a couple of Utah-centric provisions in the Big Beautiful Bill, and they were both stripped out. We had the AI moratorium that some of our state legislatures were really pushing back on, saying, we don't want you to prevent us from making things safer for AI technologies as they come online. And then the public land sale was a big one. We talked about that a lot on this show. Senator Mike Lee tried to have some of our federal lands up for sale, create a process for that, and that was stripped out sort of at the last hour. What do you make of those two things being stripped out? Good news, bad news? Or are those two, I know they're completely different issues, but will they come back in some form?
I think we can both agree that the AI piece is good news, very good news. I'm always about federalism, state control. I thought that was ridiculous in the first place. I couldn't believe it was there. Again, going back to, I think if this same bill was out 15 years ago, you couldn't find a Republican that would vote for it. Mm-hmm. So that one I'm really happy about. Obviously, I'm also very happy about the public land sales. I think there is a place in the middle where we look at public lands and consider ways to give them back to states, but that was just so overreaching and broad, and the provisions were not clear, and I was very grumpy about it.
Yeah.
So that made me really happy when
Adam,
it was pulled.
Did Mike Lee lose the messaging on that? He tried to kind of roll
the messaging,
it out.
Look, I have been a part of this this discussion with federal lands and who manages those lands and is it the state, is it the federal government, for a long time. I remember when I was working for Congressman Bishop, there was a piece of property in the city of Manaway, and some guy had died and deeded it to the Forest Service. The Forest Service didn't know they had it until the town wanted to expand their cemetery and build a fire station. And when the federal government found out they owned the land, they said, we're not giving this back to you. Mm-hmm. We don't get rid of federal land. Mm-hmm. This is ours. Mm-hmm. Well, what are you going to do with it, Forest Service? Nothing. And
they should have just used the Manaway cop. since we both went to Utah State, we know all about the Manaway cops.
Oh, totally.
But yeah. To your point, that is one tract of land. This was creating a definition that would have applied to all tracts.
There are 1.2 million acres of federal land with less than a mile away from city boundaries across the western United States. You're telling me that we shouldn't do an inventory of 1.2 million acres that could be used for housing within city limits or within a mile of city limits? You're not hunting on that land. You could be backpacking. I'm saying if you're going up in the mountains.
Technically, like Mill Creek Canyon is less than a mile away from.
It is. And I think that there should be a discussion of, I think reasonable people can look at that land and say, we're not going to build affordable housing up Mill Creek Canyon. That's off. But there's a little tract of land here.
But there wasn't carve outs for that in this provision. And that's, I think, what was troubling some folks.
National forests, national parks.
Sure.
They're not going to. Every time we have this argument, there's SUA or a lot of environmentalist groups will put the Sierra Club. They put a picture of Congressman Rob Bishop up with a picture of Arches National Park and said he wants to strip mine Arches National Park because there was a uranium mine they were opening in Arizona.
Yeah, it's really easy for those groups to come out.
It's a money grab. It's an easy way to raise money. What I want is the actual discussion, and I think that was missing from this debate. I'm fine if if we have the discussion and it dies on the merits, fine. But the rhetoric that I was hearing, which is not surprising on the federal stage, I thought was a little misleading.
Yeah.
Was it the right policy? Maybe not.
Well, and that's kind of what I'm trying to drill down on, is this created a definition, a process by which lands could be sold. It had to be within 5 miles, right, of the border of a population center. That was defined as 1,000 people, right? So that's what I'm saying, is we had a definition that was applying to all federal tracts of land. And to your point, there are tracts of land that could be better used, perhaps, but did this definition get at what you say is the best policy?
When I talk to my students about this, because I did my master's thesis on federally designated lands, so like looking at every county in the United States that has federally designated lands to see what the impact of that land is to the county. And I mean, I will tell you, there's a lot of federally designated lands in Nevada that is not pretty, right? Mm-hmm. So yes, there is an argument there, but I think it comes down to—
But no one wants to build a house there either.
Yeah. I know, they don't need water. Yeah,
by Area 51.
Right.
Has to have infrastructure for housing.
So yeah. if you think about it as a more of a philosophical view, it's like there are people who would like that land to be open regardless, right? Build up, build density, find other ways to build affordable housing. We want this land to be open. That is what it's designated for. And it doesn't matter if it's close to a city center. It doesn't matter if it's an ugly piece of land in Nevada. They're like, no, it's open spaces, and we need open spaces that's public and everyone owns it, right?
Yeah. Okay, interesting. Well, it didn't make it in, so it won't be in this version unless in some capacity Celeste Malloy brings it back. And I'm speculating here. I have no inside information or reporting at all.
I think Ryan Zinke's going to kill it. He's the Republican congressman from Montana. He was also President Trump's Secretary of Interior. And it's interesting. He has like the exact same perspective as Donald Trump Jr. They're both avid hunters on public lands. And they are not for getting rid of any public lands at all. They want the feds to manage and control everything. So not a typical like Utah conservative viewpoint. And he's like, over my dead body will this stuff come back.
There was a handful of Republican senators in on the House side who were saying no public land sale. We will tank the whole BBB if this
Idaho
public land sale
was very against it.
Yeah. Yep. So
speaking of the environment, I'm interested to hear what your thoughts are on all of the renewable projects that are going to be impacted by this bill.
I was just about to get there.
Because I am curious, because I mean, like, from my perspective, I see a lot of like solar and a lot of renewables not necessarily being a blue and red type thing.
Sure.
It's actually a moneymaker for a lot of industries in Utah. We all know people who sell solar bros in the summer or whatever. This bill will increase our energy prices because of the decisions we're making to cut the projects in renewables. So I'm curious what.
So I actually think a lot of the renewable stuff that I like the geothermal, some of these tax credits that stayed in, props to Senator Curtis. He worked his tail off to make sure that a lot of them stayed in, stuff that was really important to him. I mean, he represented the eastern side of the state when he was in Congress, and now obviously the whole state. That was really important to him. He's a big conservative climate activist. So a lot of those were able to stay in, which I was really happy to see. Utah is in such a weird position because sometimes we try and keep some of those things out because our energy is so, our electricity is so cheap here compared to other states, that we kind of do battle with other Western like-minded states sometimes. But I think there was kind of a good balance struck here, and I give props to Senator Curtis.
Yeah, solar is the one I've been following the most, and it feels...
Are you talking about like rooftop solar, or are you talking about utility scale?
Yeah,
I love the utility scale solar stuff.
Like building solar panels in the United States. It feels like that industry is being really impacted. We even saw a bunch of bills in the Utah legislature last session, like hurting our solar and our opportunity to be a solar provider, a solar builder, solar companies in the state of Utah. And so, I don't know. I think that anything that
you and I agree, we need net metering, man. We need. I need to get paid for my energy production on my roof.
I am so down with that. Anything that takes away from our opportunity to make clean energy, I think is not a great decision, and that is in that bill. I mean, they talked about coal again, and I'm just like, coal, there's like more people that work for JCPenney that mine in coal mines. So it's like, how are we still talking about this? So.
No shade to JCPenney.
If you
want to go get your glamour shots,
we call it Coles Cash.
It's Coles Cash. It's a great place. Okay. Well, maybe Adam, in just our final minutes, I know we're not going to get to our final topics. Utah's suing Snapchat and governor's asking you to pray for rain. So those are the topics. But just staying on the Big Beautiful Bill, can you hit on what actually is in the Big Beautiful Bill with regard to energy? Because I was confused on, we took out the punishments on solar and wind projects. Like that was kind of like the big piece, but then we did allow for some things to stay in. Are you able to kind of like run through what we actually left in there?
Yes. I can.
When you get to the
post. I have a little cheat sheet
right.
Of some of the stuff that stayed in. And actually, there were a huge amount of things. A lot of these were Biden rules that he put in place that both the House and the Senate version, they took out.
Yeah.
They rescinded a lot of these rules. But some of them didn't pass muster when they got to the Senate because of the Byrd rule.
And it'll be interesting to see after all of this if... It completely changes again in the House, right?
Yeah. You know, because we completely took out an excess tax on solar and wind projects.
Yes.
That was something that was giving people a lot of heartburn. Mm-hmm. But there are still some like credits in there. So like if you're already working on a project with wind and solar, you can still get credit for
it. Yeah. The Democratic talking point is that there was $1 billion given to President Trump to get from oil and gas, and so he's doing what he can to provide for them. That's kind of the Democrat talking point.
There's also provision in both the House and the Senate where it says that of the revenue that generates from renewable energy leases on federal lands, 25% shall go to the state, 25% to the county, and the remainder is federal revenue, which is great for local governments and for the state. So that will hopefully encourage some of this development on federal lands. This is also going to be big with CITLA. CITLA lands that are check marked throughout the state, if they can partner on federal land and actually get access to some of these projects, that could be really big for the state and counties.
We always love collaboration, so let's end on a kumbaya. Federal government and states work together, shall we? Sarah Real, Adam Gardner, thank you both for your insights today. We appreciate it. As always, you can see our weekly broadcast show of Inside Utah Politics on ABC4. And then we're also in podcast form wherever you podcast. Just search for Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ertz. You'll find it there. Producer Peter, always appreciate you. You were quiet today.
Getting a wave in before the end of the show.
I didn't come to you.
I thought we were ending in a prayer for rain.
Oh, do you want to pray? Should we have a prayer? Should we close with a prayer
for
rain?
Whatever works.
Pray on your own time, folks. I do have to hit this close button.
Prayers and practical solutions is the line. All right, you guys, we'll see you next time. Appreciate you watching.